This is Jazz Talk, presented by Melbourne International Jazz Festival. We would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which our festival takes place and pay respects to their elders past, present and future, as well to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the wider Melbourne community and beyond. We are honoured to contribute to over 60,000 years of music making, knowledge sharing and storytelling that has taken place on this land. I'm Chelsea Wilson. Welcome to Jazz Talk. This episode features a conversation with guitarist Al Di Meola, recorded live at the Channel Arts Centre Melbourne as part of the 2022 Melbourne International Jazz Festival. With a celebrated international career spanning almost five decades, Grammy-winning Al Di Meola has been awarded the BBC Lifetime Achievement Award and the honorary Miles Davis Award, presented by the Montreal Jazz Festival. A prolific composer, Di Meola has amassed over 20 albums as a leader, while collaborating on many more with artists such as fusion supergroup Return to Forever, with the late Chick Corea, Stanley Clarke and Lenny White, and the celebrated acoustic guitar trio featuring fellow virtuosos John McLaughlin and Paco de Lucia. A pioneer of blending jazz with musical styles from around the world, Al Di Meola's virtuosic technique on both acoustic and electric guitars has afforded him regal status among guitar fanatics and record collectors alike. In this conversation, PBS broadcaster Saul Saravase talks to Al Di Meola about his time with Return to Forever, the guitar trio, and much more.
Well, first of all, welcome to Melbourne and buenas tardes, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to Melbourne for the second time, I believe, in your career.
Yeah, the second time, 40 years ago, I was here.
Now, you came with the guitar trio, which right, I want right. to kick off with. I was told many stories of how you came about to be part of the guitar trio. Could you please tell us?
Well, it started, let's see... when I was 19, I got the fortunate invitation to join Return to Forever with Chick Corea and Stanley Clarke and Lenny White. And at the time, I was at Berklee School of Music. And I think it was the first tour we did of Europe. And when we got to Spain, everybody was talking about this new flamenco guy. That just was blowing everybody away. He was kind of like the up and coming, like new sensation over there. So I went to the local department store, El Corte Inglés, and I went to the record department and bought a few of his records. And I went back to the States, and when I played these records, I was just blown away with, you know, how he was taking that whole idiom up to, you know, another level. And just had it in the back of my mind to do something with him at some point. And that time came when I was planning my second solo album, Elegant Gypsy.
Yep.
And, you know, I had my record company contact his record company in Madrid and see if they can have him come over. And they thought it was a great opportunity for him to get exposure in North America. So
he came over.
He came over and, you know, I didn't speak a word of English, and my Spanish was not good either. So he had a friend of his that came with him, was an interpreter, and, you know, he felt really outside of his comfort zone. You know, we were sitting in the studio. This was a Jimi Hendrix studio, Electric Ladyland, and, you know, we did maybe three or four takes, and it wasn't quite there yet. So his friend comes over to me and goes, he whispers in my ear, you know, Paco can't play unless he has weed. And so I said, well, I you know, I don't really, but wait a minute, I know a friend of mine is in the other room. So this friend of mine went out and got him, you know, two feet outside of Electric Ladyland, you know, in the Greenwich Village, you know, everybody's selling pot, right? So Paco, you know, got nice and high, and the first take, that's the one that's on the record. And you can hear him at the end going, whoosh. because it was really
hear that right at the end of the tune. How
you heard that?
Exhale. Yeah.
Yeah, that's him.
Yeah.
That's him, and everybody in the control room was high-fiving. You know, it was really a special moment. You know,
fantastic.
So that piece, you know, surprisingly to both of us, became a hit single, and mostly in Europe, a hit single, but it sold really well throughout the world, and that gave us an idea of you know, maybe someday. It was more like maybe someday we'll tour, but then we were approached by an impresario who became like one of the biggest promoters in the world. It was his idea to put us together with John McLaughlin, and I said, "Man, if you get that trio together, the three of us, it's going to be explosive," you know. And so this one guy, his name is Barry Marshall, he organized this 2-month tour that started in Scandinavia and went down all the way through Europe, Central and Southern, and then we went over to the States and Australia. You know, I think the second time it was Australia. What year was it?
The second time around.
Do you remember the year I was here? I don't even remember. It was 1980 or 83?
83, I think.
83? Okay, it was the second tour. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you put together Saturday Night in San Francisco.
Right. Thank you very much.
How difficult was that? Why did it take so long?
Well, I had I had all of the tapes of the whole European tour. You know, we recorded nearly all the shows. I mean, with recording trucks. So I had all the 2-inch reels. I wound up getting them all because we mixed Friday Night in San Francisco in White Plains, New York, which is right across the river from where my house is. And, you know, the studio said to me, "Hey, what are we going to do with all these tapes?" You know, and I knew Paco was going back to Spain, and John was living, I think, in France. And so I said, "Well, I'll take them. You know, you could ship them to me. I'm right across the river." So I wound up with, like, you know, 150 boxes of tapes. So I went through all of those tapes. It wasn't recent that I went through them. I knew I had Saturday Night for a long time, actually. And I approached John's manager, I think, midway through, you know, 20 years in. And Paco was just, you know, he was just constantly touring. He wasn't focused on it. But I say, "Hey, guys, you know, I have another night. And I think there's enough of material to make another record." But they were too preoccupied. So it never really got off the ground at that time, which was probably, you know, 95 or something, 1995. But I transferred the tapes myself to DAT just to preserve.
To DAT.
Yeah, to DAT.
Wow.
And the funny thing is, so I went looking for those DAT tapes in 2020 when we were all like secluded in our homes because of COVID.
I get it.
And I couldn't find the DATs anywhere. So, but I had the tape. So then I had the tapes I brought to a studio that professionally bakes them. They bake the tape to preserve the sound. And then we transferred it to Pro Tools. And it turns out that the sound was really great still.
It sounds terrific. After 40 years,
which was really you know, remarkable. And then I had it baked a second time at the Skywalker Studios, George Lucas Studio, which... They're like the top in the business for restoring videotape for motion picture and also audio. And I spent most of my time with an engineer editing. That took the most time. Because a lot of those pieces that wound up on Saturday Night were really long, super long. So I had to make the sides work for the vinyl, the 33 and the 45, which comes out next year.
Great news.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And you have a sold out concert tomorrow, and what are you bringing to us? Talk to me.
Well, it's a lot of new music that I've written in 2020.
All right.
And I've been recording for the last 2 years this new album that I think is on another level, and so I'm going to be playing a lot of this new music. I'm going to mix it up with some older pieces, not too many, but some, and. I'm going to also like I do at every show, I always have something of Piazzolla, because Piazzolla was a big influence to me. We became friends in the years before he passed. And, man, you know, the next record, if he hadn't passed, would have been a duet record of me and him that we were planning.
Well, you do have a few tango records.
I have tribute records to him. And so his influence was pretty great. And as well as Chick Corea's. I mean, you know, I had really great inspiring
about,
people.
You know, the frustration of my life not seeing Return to Forever with you. He came along with Jean-Luc Ponty as a guest. And
The Return to Forever
Return
version.
To Forever, yeah.
They called it Return to Forever 4.
Yeah, 2011. Yeah, so where is Aldi? Nowhere.
What's that?
Where is Aldi?
I know. Well, you had a guy from Melbourne playing in the band, I think.
Well, what about the musicians that are playing with you right now?
One is from Mumbai. He plays tabla, and I think he's like the leading tabla player there is right now of the new school of tabla playing. His name is Amit Kavlekar, and it's something different and unusual for me. The thing about that is I'm not really trying to do Indian music or Indian scales or any kind of thing like that. And within my music, he's really kind of applying what he does to my music.
To your music.
And then I have a more of a Spanish flamenco type of percussionist from, he lives in Valencia, but he's from Madrid, okay. Sergio Martinez. So I have these two different worlds on both sides. And some of the stuff is very well orchestrated, you know, between the two of them, you know.
Fantastic. Now, what sort of the classical Aldi Meola, because you have some new music coming up, what of the classical Aldi Meola are you going to play tomorrow?
Well, you know, it's
anything that we
know. The obligation is to play Mediterranean Sundance, yeah.
Fantastic.
Of course.
Now, for the audience, I'm sure that we have some guitar fans here. Tell us about not just this tour, which you are playing with acoustic guitar, 100% correct, no electrical at all?
No electric.
No. What sort of guitars are you using? What models are you using? What sort of technology?
I've been using, you know, I've switched from playing an Ovation more than 20 years ago. I just wanted to get more of that as a cross between classical and flamenco sound on a nylon. And it's the same company that made Paco's guitars.
Okay.
So it's the same Conde Hermanos.
So the same luthier. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Very good. Now, you over the years, you always go different genres. You always go different directions. Sometimes you play tango, sometimes you play flamenco. You did release a very nice album of the Beatles, second album that you have dedicated to their music.
Right.
You're going to play some of that as well?
Yeah, we'll play some of that.
Very, very good. Now, we do have a mobile mic that's going to happen very soon. So start thinking about what question would you like to ask Mr. Meola. Now, tell us, you started the tour to Honolulu.
Yes, this segment started in Honolulu at the Blue Note.
Then
they
Japan,
have a Blue Note club there.
Then, so it has been like your jet lag nightmare for you going backwards in time, I suppose.
I have plenty of sleeping aids to put me right to sleep when I need to sleep. I have to have that.
Now, I obviously follow you on social media, and the reaction of the public, you have taken quite a few selfies and quite a few videos with the public. Tell us about the difference between each audience when you go and play.
Oh, my God. It's so different, you know, like Japan, for instance, you know, they were, there was like signs put up before they entered the room that they were not allowed to show any emotion at all, like zero. They could clap, but they couldn't, like, they couldn't go, you know.
Nothing.
Like in what we're used to in the States, you know. So they would, because of the, with their fear of spreading, you know, this non-existent COVID thing that's gone, you know. But they're so fearful, you know. So they're all wearing masks. And even though they're wearing masks, they just didn't want
them. They couldn't shout.
They were really serious about no talking, no no show of emotion through the mouth.
Well, we're going to have to make some noise, guys. So.
No, and it was a drag, too. I mean, it was like, oh, my God, is anybody out there? Hello? <You know? laughs> Korea was a little better. There wasn't that kind of restriction.
I saw you with a little robot in a hotel. You had an assistance.
Yeah. That was the big hit with my daughter, the robot, you know. In fact, if you look, you see all the comments. There's like hundreds of comments. And,
Absolutely.
And I think views, there was thousands of views, you know.
Oh, yeah, I prefer the human touch and all sort of stuff. But it's the novelty, you know. I think
that was kind of cool. It was like a room service thing. So, like, if you wanted to order, like, a dessert or a drink or something, they had this mobile robot that came from downstairs and it finds its way upstairs through the elevator. And it goes all the way down a hall to your room. And then my phone rings and the phone goes, your mobile unit is at the door. And I open and the robot's right there.
Now, what's next? What's next for you after this tour is gone?
I have a tour of Europe in November with some orchestras, which is something we started doing in the summer. Because there'd be two or three pieces with the chamber orchestra on the record. So I'm also going to be performing in Italy with this orchestra as well.
And any plans to do electric guitar work?
There's some electric guitar on the new record. You know, I get the itch every now and then. But
I love when you combine them.
I love the electric guitar.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, I had so many years of playing electric guitar, you know, and playing next to loud drummers and everything. And Chick Corea playing up in the high end of the Fender Rhodes with his amp here. I was 19 years old. He had his horn. The horn to his speaker was here. So when he got da 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 da, it was like blades going through my eardrum. So I have tinnitus.
Wow.
And not just a little tinnitus.
Jeez.
And it doesn't like change. It's 24/7 screaming. And that's what will happen to some people, not everybody, but some, you know. Nearly all of us will lose some of our hearing, you know. That's easy to deal with, you know. There's plenty of things you could do for
technology.
Loss of some kind.
Technology,
but not for tinnitus. Zero.
Wow.
Not a thing.
Now tell us about your feelings when you heard that Chick left.
Oh, God, overwhelming. Yeah, it was overwhelming, you know. But they, you know, they kept it kind of quiet, you know, like it. They kind of made it sound like he went to the doctor one day and the doctor said, you have a very rare form of cancer. You know, and he kind of asked the doctor, well, how bad? And the doctor said, real bad. And he says, well, how long do I have? He says, like a week.
Jeez.
It's just like in the movies. You see some movies. How long do I have, doc? You know. So he had very little time. This is what I heard through the grapevine, but they're very quiet about it. Your chick was a Scientologist, so they're very secretive about stuff. And they were really against drugs that could have kept some people alive. So if there was something like that that could have kept them alive, it was kind of forbidden, you know, because they were really anti most drugs, you know.
I can imagine the shock and not being able to say goodbye was.
Well, he wrote a letter. I mean, he handled it like a champ. I mean, he just wrote this goodbye letter to everybody and just thanked everyone for all the years of support and everything. It was, how can you do that, you know? I'd be so broken up, I don't know if I can hold a pen, you know? Mm-hmm. But he wrote this beautiful letter, you know, saying he had a great life and everything. Paco was more of a shock in a sense. But then again, he was a chain smoker. The yes, chick was a chain smoker.
He was.
So I think there's some kind of correlation. Even if you stop, there's a certain damage that was done.
I think so. I agree with that. Yeah, Paco wanted to play until he dropped. That's what he wishes was when they discovered he had cancer. He just wanted to play. That's it. And he played.
Oh, no, but he had a heart attack on the beach.
No, I thought he was diagnosed. No, he wasn't.
Paco.
Yeah, Paco.
Yeah, he was playing soccer with his son on the beach in Mexico, and he had an attack, and they rushed him.
My mistake.
They rushed him to the hospital, and he didn't make it.
I thought he was sick.
And we just did a tribute, beautiful tribute. I was part of it, and so was John McLaughlin, a tribute to Paco. It took that long to put it together, but it was a big deal in Madrid. It was only, it was in August.
Yeah, I did see some videos of that. Now, let's see if we can get the microphones to the audience to listen to some questions.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
So, tinnitus, as I understand it, is a constant ringing in your ear.
Right.
I don't know if you had perfect pitch before tinnitus, but does that basically give you perfect pitch?
No, it doesn't mess with the pitch and so much. It's just it's annoying, you know, especially in quiet rooms. So I sleep with white noise, you know, white noise on my phone and a whole lot of other stuff to knock me out. So I'm really leery of loud amps and, you know, cymbals, and, you know, I'm just really careful so it doesn't get worse, you know. Because I don't think we'll see a remedy for this kind of thing in this lifetime. I think it really has to do with not the ears at all. It's the center of the brain. It controls the hearing, you know, so it's that, unfortunately, it's in the center of the brain, so it's hard to get to, you know.
Thank you, and welcome to Melbourne. It's a great honour.
Thank you very much.
What inspires you to play music? What gives you the spiritual feeling about playing music?
Well, it's something that you just you know, you need. I don't know. You know, I almost at 7 years old, I almost didn't make it from an accident, and I was in the hospital for 2 months. And when I got out of this thing, I just had this amazing kind of drive and passion for music. And it just, I shortly after that, I started taking lessons. And I was just totally immersed in the music of the 60s. And I got to go to a lot of phenomenal shows in New York City because I was only half an hour from the city. And it was a passion. You know, as much as my parents tried to steer me away from it, you know, yeah, take up a trade, you know, making it into music is going to be hard, yeah. But it was just, can't explain it.
What kept you going?
What kept me going? I just knew at a very early age that, you know, I had this drive that I was going to make it when I'm young. And it's almost like there's a higher power up there that saw me through a devastating accident that I had and said, okay, you're going to make it. So when I went to Berkeley, I got the call from Chick. You know, and Chick calls me up. It's my favorite group. They were cutting edge, man. Return to Forever was like, you know, it was like Weather Report, Return to Forever, and Mahavishnu. And while I was going to school, I went to see Return to Forever up in Boston a couple of times. The last time they had Earl Klug playing. And Well, I love Earl Klute, but can you imagine Earl Klute? He's an acoustic player. Great. Great player. But he was standing there with a Les Paul playing through a Marshall. And I said, what the hell? So I called a friend of mine back in New Jersey. This friend of mine is like, he's much older than me. And he was like this Woodstock hippie guy. He was always high. But he was also like his amateur recording engineer. So I called Michael up. And I said, Mike, I just saw Return to Forever, and now they got Earl Klute in the band. I don't know if Earl fits in that kind of band, but man, I'd give anything to play with Return to Forever. That's all I said. And so he took it upon himself to go in the city. He had made a tape of me on a New Year's Eve show that I playing with the Barry Miles Quartet. Barry Miles was this great jazz pianist when I was 17. And he, it was just one of those nights that he said, Al, you got to take this. It was a tab of acid. And I was on a psychedelic trip like you can't imagine. It was so beautiful. And that's the tape that Chick heard. He went in the city. he gave the tape. Chick heard this tape, me playing lines that I can't even play today. I heard that tape and go, Jesus Christ. It's like he hired somebody else. I never played that good since. I'm not kidding.
I find that hard to believe.
No, it's true. It's true. I might even put that record out someday. It's a cassette, but it's... I said, holy Jesus. I mean, look, the Beatles, they were doing LSD, and they came up with some great stuff. And I haven't done it since, but that's the tape. So she calls me up, he goes... Is this Al DiMiola? I go, yeah, who's this? He goes, this is Chick Corea. I said, no, it's not. He goes, oh, this is Chick. Your friend Mike came in the city and he really bothered us until we listened to this tape, you know. I said, which tape is it? He said, something from New Year's Eve. I go, oh, Jesus Christ. So he goes, we'd love you to come down to New York and join the band. I said, wow.
Join the band. Not even rehearse,
join.
Not
he
try.
Said, join, not even
just
try
join
out.
The band.
They were so blown away with that tape. I said, whoa, really? What do you want me to do? He goes, well, we're going to rehearse the next few days in New York. If you can come right away. And then we're playing Carnegie Hall, sold out on Tuesday night. I said, what? I said, oh, my God. So I looked at my girlfriend. I said, hey, look, I'm leaving. She goes, where are you going, to the store? I said, no, I'm leaving for good. And I went home.
Incredible.
Home where my parents, you know, live in New Jersey, and I knocked on the door. My mother always had the door locked in the daytime. She goes, what are you doing home from school? I said, Mom, I'm playing Carnegie Hall on Tuesday night. She goes, what? And my father's in the background. He goes, get the hell out of here. You're not playing Carnegie Hall. I said, Dad, I'm playing Carnegie Hall with Chick Corea. He goes, who the hell is Chick Corea? I said, that, it's my favorite band, Return to Forever. So it took about an hour for me to repeat myself. So I went in the city, 2-3 days rehearsal of these 11-page charts of some of my favorite music, right? And some brand new, a lot of brand new music for a record we later recorded. And then, you know, I was nervous as hell. Oh, my God. You know, 19 years old, my first show, Carnegie Hall. Just Jesus. So they sent a limo out to pick me up. Mm. So I took my parents with me. My father and mother are sitting in the back of the limo, like, facing me. My father's going like this. He goes, you know, Albert. He always called me Albert. You know, Albert, I always did tell you, you know how you get the Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't say it out loud, but I'm thinking, it's acid, acid, acid. Yeah. I'm the only one that could say that.
Now, Mike Stern is on the record saying that Miles Davis used to tell him, I want you to rock it like Hendrix. You know?
Oh, he loved rock. He loved the whole, you know,
Did you get that call from Chick? Come on, rock it. You rock it.
Yeah, yeah. He saw, you know, the first version of Return to Forever, I also was a big fan of, and that was like a more of a Brazilian jazz thing, but I aired Tone Floor and Joe Farrell. But then when he saw Mahavishnu, it blew him away. So he loved the energy of the guitar, especially the electric guitar. So a lot of those songs he wrote were for guitar.
Okay. Fantastic. Who else is now ready?
Thank you. Welcome to Melbourne, Al. And my name is Bernardo. I listened a lot to your music when I was in college, and I like your compositions. Do you have like advice in terms of composing for guitar?
Yes. The way I compose is I never start with a melody. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Like if you come up with a melody, what does it mean if it doesn't apply to anything? So I usually first come up with an arpeggiated harmonic sequence of some kind. And if I like it, I write it down, you know, and writing a melody to that after the fact is far easier. So it's usually me just sitting with my instrument and coming up with kind of pattern that's usually a syncopated kind of harmonic sequence, you know. I started with bing di 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 ding di 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 di. To me, it's super easy, you know. It's, you know, it's funny. I've written far more complex and to me far more interesting pieces, but it's that piece is just, it's like the hit single kind of thing, you know.
It's similar to Enter the Sideways,
yeah. Right. And I didn't play it for a lot of years if I was the only guitar player playing in the band, you know, because I really feel it's a two-guitar piece, but I've managed to, you know, play it anyway.
Yeah. Thank you. My question is, after everything you have accomplished in your musical career, after everything you have done and learned after all these years, is there anything you are searching for now? Is there anything maybe more sublime you're trying to find in music?
It's more of an evolution that's happened naturally. And I saw a big jump in this period in which we were kind of sequestered in our homes. And for me, in my studio downstairs, my home, that it was a kind of way for me to meditate away from other things. Like when I'm reading music, it takes me away from all of life's problems and whatever might be happening, that both negative or whatever. Writing music is therapeutic for me, and that happens, you know. And I think the evolution of my writing has happened just quite naturally, but I think that certain things happened in these last few years that brought it to another level. And you know, it's making records now is just, you know, for the sake of art. It's not for the sake of sales, you know. So art must be made. We must have music in order to survive, I think, you know. Just like motion pictures, you know, paintings, you know, if we don't have art in our lives, you know, we'd go crazy. If we didn't have music, imagine life without music, you know. So
we do need the recordings because that's your painting.
Right. But it used to be, you know, it was sales motivated, you know, but you know, not that I was ever told what to record, but, you know, now it's like you do it solely for the art. For yourself, and then hopefully there's an audience that likes it too.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you.
Hi,
Make
Al.
Noise.
I had two questions, if that's okay. So the first one, I was lucky enough to see when you came out the first time in the 80s, and that's an amazing, you know, memory for me. I remember you came out with Steve Morse supporting, so, you know, another fantastic guitarist but very different genre. So I was wondering how you got him involved. And my second question is, are there any other guitarists, especially, you know, different genres that you really admire or enjoy listening to?
Right, well, okay. It's a very good question, the first one. How did Steve Morse ever get on that tour, right? It's because I had a bad back and I kind of backed out of the tour. I was in so much pain and I just said, I don't think I could do it that particular summer. I think, I don't know what that was, 82 or 83, whatever it was. And so John must have recommended to Paco Steve Morse. So I think Steve Morse, from what I heard, went down to Mexico where Paco was kind of, he had a second home there. And the thing is, Paco calls me and he begged me to come back. Because, you know, I'm not a flamenco player, okay? But one thing Paco and I had was a very strong rhythmic compatibility. You know, we both understood syncopation and how to play against the clave. And that's something you can't teach. You either have it or you don't. It's not something you can learn. It's just one of those things. John definitely does not have it. He has another thing, and it's beautiful. And that's what made the trio really interesting, that we were all quite different. But Steve didn't have that Latin thing as well. Great player, phenomenal. So to cool the whole thing out, since I kind of, you know, Paco kind of begged me, I said, okay, I get it. So I went back, and we then kind of moved Steve to the opening slot of the show, which was great for him. And then we invited him for the encore, which I forget which piece we played, but I know he came out at the end. And that's how that answers your question.
Any other guitarists you really admire?
There's a lot of great new guitarists that are coming up. That it's like endless how many great guitar players there are. This kid from Sicily is just blowing everybody away. Is it Matteo Mancuso? Jesus Christ. I mean, he looks like he's 12. He's 25 years old, but he looks like he's 12. And, like, we all know about him. Like, everybody knows. He came out of nowhere. He's kind of like he's not a flamenco player, but he plays with his fingers. So freaking fast, it's scary. Great lines, the whole nine yards. He came out of nowhere. From Sicily? How did this happen, right? So, you know, this is one of the guys I discovered during that whole lockdown time. Like, we were all online through that whole COVID thing. Discovered a lot of new players, right? So this past summer, actually was offered a show with him. He was the opening act with his trio, and I said, well, if he's the opening act, then we got to play, you know, at the end of my show, and then we did. It's phenomenal. So we'll probably do some more together. Yeah. He'll kick my ass, too. Oh, yeah. But that just makes me play, you know, not so relaxed. You know? It was like that with Paco, too. You know,
well, you do challenge each other. That's
oh my God!
You do challenge each other.
It was war, but it was a healthy war. I mean, but we look. It was the best of times, man. There was no cell phone. There was no computers. That extra 6-7 hours a day we spend on those goddamn things. We had all that extra time to practice. So when at night when we got on the stage, you know, somebody launched into a solo, it was like, you know, sitting there, I go, holy Christ, how am I gonna top that? You know, But you know, it brings you to another place.
Well, I had
it brings you out of your comfort zone, and that's how you grow. You know.
I heard an interview with him, and he blamed you for the headaches that he used to get after playing with you.
Oh yeah, we tortured headaches. One another. You know.
Yeah, he said that he didn't know how to improvise. That you took it out of him comfort zone.
He, you know, you have to give him credit, man. He had the guts to step outside of the comfort zone, because in his comfort zone he was the king. He still is considered the king, right? But there's a lot of those flamenco guys that are afraid to step out of that, you know.
He felt alleviated in some ways, because in flamenco you have to be perfect. In jazz you don't have to. You play a note and you keep going.
No, he wanted to improvise in more unorthodox harmony.
Right.
And that's what he got.
Yeah, headaches.
Yeah, it was. He wanted to go through that torture. It's kind of like the torture I would go through if I, you know, one of these young hotshots, you know, if I have to play with one of them.
Bring it on. Like,
yeah, okay.
Next.
It's something that he wanted. He looked forward to going through it, but it was, absolutely. You know, it comes with pain.
Yeah.
Growing pain. Yeah.
And we are grateful. And we are absolutely grateful.
I was grateful. I mean, I was the kid, you know,
The fact that you can not only play against the clave, but also change to the rumba flamenca.
Yeah.
Rhythm and the
when we played rhythm together for John when John soloed, it was killer.
Yeah.
It was like we were definitely like. We were like this. It was really beautiful.
But it has to be relaxed. Remember that.
Without a doubt. You know, because, you know, John comes from, he was very influenced by a lot of the Indian traditional music. And a lot of that music is very kind of pushes. It's very much on top. It does not relax. It's a different kind of thing.
Well, he
also
he,
great, but different.
Yeah. His solos are extra long. His solos are extra long, like
too long.
Yeah,
I had the editor that was still so he would always take. Oh God, he's taking another chorus. Oh my God, and I hope this is the end. Oh, he's going again. Oh God, you know. Meanwhile, he took so many choruses, and mainly because he wanted to feel like at the end of the solo he got it, you know.
Yeah, the synergy between you three.
Yeah,
it's great to have you three playing, but I have to admit, I do enjoy more that synergy between you and Paco, going back and forth.
We had a strong simpatico when it came to Latin rhythm. Big, really strong. Even though I didn't come nor was I raised in a flamenco tradition at all, you know, so there was...
A boy from New Jersey.
Yeah, but I grew up, you know, I my teenage years, I hung out at Latin clubs in New York City.
Which was the center of the Latin movement of the 70s.
Going to these Latin clubs, you know, just to listen to those Latin big bands and to absorb that, you know.
Gumby Ortiz, by the way, why didn't you bring Gumby Ortiz with you? It's your mate.
What did he want?
Why didn't he come here with you?
I love Gumby. You know, he's a brother. You know, we played together for 30 years. And he is involved with a lot of different groups in the Tampa area. He's like a local legend, you know, so he has a lot of different groups. And, you know... This music became more and more, my music became more and more involved and different parts and everything. Gumby is completely a street player. He's not a schooled player. Mm-hmm. So I sometimes need a little bit of both because, you know, this section I might have this rhythm. But then this next section might be completely other rhythm. You know, and you got to know right at that moment it has to change. So there's a lot of parts. It's far more complex than the days of Race with Devil.
looking forward to it tomorrow. Do we have time for more questions? Maybe one more?
Hello, Art. Hi. Welcome to Australia. Thank My you. Name is Luis. In an ideal world, we would like to see that trio, but of course, for obvious reasons, we can't have it again, the tour of that legendary trio. But if you would have to put that tour once again on stage, what of the guitars of the new generations would you put on to emulate the trio, the legendary trio of the San Francisco, Night in San Francisco, or with Paco, John, and yourself? What guitars of the new generation of today will you...
Of this generation?
Of this generation will you...
Well, the one guy who really followed closest to the Paco tradition, so the next generation guy, was Vicente Amigo. And then the third guy is a tough one because, you know, unless it's flamenco, there's a lot of guys I can name, you know. But if I had to replace, like, the Paco guy, I would say Vicente is... the guy, but he's so incredibly nervous to play with anybody. He's very insecure, you know. That's the thing Paco got over, you know. He wasn't afraid to step outside of his comfort zone.
Right.
Vicente is extremely afraid to step outside. In fact, he didn't even show up at the Paco tribute in Madrid, which I was shocked, because he knew that he would have to play with somebody, you know. And I don't know. Yeah, it's tough, you know.
It's a tough one. John will kill you.
Huh?
John will kill you if you leave him out.
John?
John McLaughlin.
Yeah, he played.
Yeah, I'm saying if you leave John McLaughlin out of the trio, he'll be really mad.
Oh, no, but... You mean now? He's 80. I don't know if he's mad. He might be happy.
How about Niño Josele? Have you played with him at all?
Who's this?
Niño Josele. He was the one that played in the last Chick Corea record.
Oh, I'm not familiar with him.
No familiar with him?
Yep, no. There's a lot of great guys out there.
Yeah, he played in the very last Chick Corea's
album. There's a whole Paco school of players.
Yeah.
You know, there's tons of them. So if even if it's that they didn't do it and a trio were to happen, you know. I'm actually supposed to form a trio for this big, big show in Budapest. And I said to my agent, I said, well, if we do one show, we got to do more than one show, because you can't just do one.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the rehearsals are the hardest part of this job. You can't just go on stage, do one show, and say goodbye. If you're going to rehearse, it's going to be a lot of work goes into it for a long amount of time, you know. Usually never enough time, you know. But still, if you have a bunch of days in front of that, you don't want to just end after that. So this guy from Sicily, Matteo Mancuso, is one of the guys.
Mm.
And then I'm trying to think who the third one will be.
Looking forward to
that. I have some ideas,
that.
But you know.
Make sure you record it.
Hmm?
Make sure you record it digitally this
time.
Well,
do you want to record the first show? You know what I mean? Like, San Francisco was after 2 months. Our chops were incredibly great after 2 months. They were even great at the beginning, but we just honed it, you know. We played almost every night for 2 months. No cell phones, no computers. All we did was practice.
Just play.
You know, and, you know, Paco was like the fastest guy, and John was known for his speed. And, you know, so we all had to work hard to be in top shape. So it was the last two shows we recorded after that.
Well, I have to admit, it was a long time coming, but Saturday Night in San Francisco is as good as Friday Night in San Francisco. I absolutely love it. I'm sure you guys have heard it already. And you've done a fantastic job in editing it, because I could notice that you shortened
some. That was the big work. That was the most work went into that. But luckily, you know, It was the other songs of the night. So we played the combination of what was on Friday night and on Saturday each night. Yeah. So you got the other half of the show, basically.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, guys, I think that's all we have time for. Anyone lined up for one last question?
Thanks very much. Al, welcome again back to Australia. It's great to have you here. My question to you is, on this lineup, as I understand it, there's two percussionists and, of course, yourself on guitar. I'm just wondering if there's a reason why you chose that particular lineup and not another guitar player or an accordion player, perhaps.
Yeah, here's the reason. I knew that in 2020, when COVID hit as hard as it hit, I would not be able to get my group back together so easy. So I designed a lot of my new compositions to be played solo, and some of my older stuff to be played solo. I sometimes do play with my European guy. Like he did a tour in September with me. But I wanted to be able to carry a show by myself or really spotlight what I'm doing. Because when you're in a band and you have keyboards and drums and percussion and bass and everything, you get part of me. But this is really focused a lot on kind of the new music as well. But yeah, I love playing with my second guitarist as well, you know. Because there are tunes that have a second part, like Mediterranean Sundance, or even some of the new music. I also have a second part, so I try to cover for both, you know. And
hard work.
Yeah, and I'm getting the tabla player to do things that are so outside of Indian music that, you know, if there were Indian police around, they'd definitely, oh, my God. You know, and he's like, I said, I know I'm making you do things that, you know, because they do everything like this. You know, I said, no, that rhythm, trust me, you have to do this flat hand. It's so foreign for them, you know. But it's all in the attitude. He's got the attitude. He wants to learn, you know. I'm a percussionist. I do all my percussion on my records.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for coming out, everybody. Thank you.
It has been a pleasure, and thank you guys as well. Much appreciate your presence.
That was Al Di Meola in conversation with Saul Sarvase at the 2022 Melbourne International Jazz Festival, presented with the support of Arts Centre Melbourne. Please keep in touch with Melbourne International Jazz Festival by subscribing to our e-news at melbournejazz.com. Follow us on social media and subscribe on your preferred platform for more podcast episodes. We would like to thank principal partners Creative Victoria and the Australia Council for the Arts. Thanks for listening. Thank you.